Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, a non-profit scientific organisation also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. We're just back from the ISAP annual scientific meeting in Banff, Canada. We gathered together with scientists from 24 countries for 2.5 days of discussion and learning on the science of biotics. We had presentations of the highest caliber from researchers across the globe. And in this special episode, we're sharing highlights from 4 presentations, 2 from local Canadian academics with state-of-the-art research programs, and 2 from the 2025 winners of the ISAP Early Career Researcher Awards. We hope you enjoy these insights from the 2025 ISAP annual meeting. Our first highlighted talk is by Dr. Carolina Trapini from the University of British Columbia, Canada. Dr. Trapini presented a talk at the ISAP meeting entitled Leveraging the Gut Environment for Functional Biosensor Microbes. Dr. Trapini talks about her lab's fascinating approach utilizing the natural responses of commensal microbiota to report out on physiological changes happening within the gut. Here's Dr. Trapini now.
Our lab is really interested in understanding how the physical gut environment affects the way that bacteria can grow, as well as how they can engraft in the gut, which of course is very important as we think about microbiota therapies. And it turns out that the gut has many different environments that are already set up by the physiology of the host organism. You can think about the fact that, of course, the stomach has low pH, and different secretions, both by bacteria and by the mammalian host, change the environment, both in terms of stiffness, acidity, concentration of oxygen, and all of these other factors. On top of that, if you think about what happens during disease, is that these physical parameters change even more. There's increases in temperature and changes in pH during inflammation. There may be changes in the osmolality or the concentration of molecules that happen when people have specific malabsorptions or inabilities to absorb specific nutrients, such as happens in inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease. And in our work, we've discovered that different bacteria respond very differently to these changed environments. And this causes them not only to only be able to grow within certain conditions, but also that the ones that can survive throughout these different conditions have to express different genes in order to actually be able to survive this perturbation. And so we thought that one of the ways in which we can use this information is to actually have bacteria report on the changes in the environment they feel that may be indicative of specific conditions, for example, inflammation or specific malabsorptions. So we used Bacteroides thaliodomicron, which is a common gut commensal that is prevalent in industrialized humans and is very tolerant to different perturbations, to report on conditions of a changed gut environment that will be manifested preclinically in certain types of diseases. Specifically, we focused on malabsorption, so the inability to absorb specific molecules. And we looked at the genes that were being expressed by Bacteroides in the context of this increased osmolality within different environments, both in vitro as well as in vivo. We then looked at this transcriptional response, and we used the promoters that were activated by Bacteroides to connect them to a genetic circuit that will allow to change the expression levels of a fluorescent protein, such that when the condition of increased osmolality and so therefore of malabsorption is experienced by the bacterium, it's actually able to tell us by a change in fluorescence that these changes have been experienced. We then tested this in a model of very mild malabsorption to a level that would not be able to be detected preclinically or clinically, either by looking at the stool consistency or by changes in the physiology of the animal. And we were able to see that even at the lowest level of malabsorption, these bacteria were able to report on these changes. What we then did was to also look at other types of perturbations. So we looked at inflammation, and we were able to see changes in situ of different inflammatory states based on the expression of these reporters. And so what we're really excited about in the next steps is thinking about these commensal microbiota members that are actually able to report on changes in conditions, as well as are able to tell us what they're experiencing in the gut, because at the level and at the scale that they're able to sense the environment, so within just microns, they're going to have much higher sensitivity than any of the methods that we currently have as the gold standard for reporting on a lot of diseases, which conversely have to detect signals that will be diluted in kilograms of stool or liters of blood or other fluids.
Thank you, Dr. Trapini. We're looking forward to seeing where this innovative work leads in the future, and to the insights that biosensor microbes might deliver. The next annual meeting talk we highlight in this episode is by Professor André Moret from Laval University, Canada. Professor Moret's extensive research focuses on metabolic health and the gut microbiota, and here he provides an overview of the state of research and future targets for next-generation probiotics for metabolic and liver health. Here's Professor Moret.
So my name is Professor André Moret from Laval University. I was invited to the ISEP meeting to present about next-generation probiotics for metabolic and liver disease, and what is the current state of the situation with those products. So I presented the different type of categories that are considered therapeutic molecules derived from the microbiome, of course, including probiotics. And I started to discuss the FMTs, or the fecal microbiota transplantation, which has been used for hundreds of years to treat some disease, probably more than that from China, where FMT were used to treat gastrointestinal pain. So FMT, of course, works. They work for chronic C. difficile infection or recurrent C. difficile infection. For metabolic disease, they have not been used widely. They have been tested, so they are proof of concept that they can work to improve insulin sensitivity, for example, in people with metabolic syndrome. But the effect, you know, will work for a few weeks. Then you have to do another FMT. So we need to improve the type of bacteria that we use, or I should say microbiome products that we use to treat metabolic syndrome. Clearly, FMT is not the solution for long-term effect to reduce insulin resistance or other factors related to the metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes in general. So many, many groups have developed over the last 10 years what we consider second generation, you know, microbiome therapeutics, which are more defined bacterial cocktails or bacterial groups that are known now to be probiotics or to act as probiotics. These second generation products or probiotics, of course, are more defined organism. There is a reduced risk of inadvertently transferring unknown bacterial pathogens when you do such transfer or when you do such treatment with second generation probiotics. We have reviewed the different type of probiotics that were used in clinical trials. There's not so many of them. Most of the trials have been done for treatment of intestinal inflammatory disease. For purely metabolic studies, there's very few of them. Unfortunately, information is often lacking about the strains that were used in these studies. So in general, there's more work that needs to be done. But clearly, the probiotics that have been tested in the context of metabolic disease and liver disease were Lactobacillus helveticus or Bifidobacterium lactis. So different type of these two major, family of bacteria. And I think there's a general feeling in the field that we need to go beyond those strains or family of bacteria needs to go and finding new probiotics or new strains that may have different functional capacity than just the production of short-chain fatty acids, which of course have beneficial impact in the gut. But maybe when you want to treat metabolic disease, you have to consider other type of functions of the bacteria. And there's also, when you review the literature on those second generation probiotics, there's a lot of variation in the effect, inter-individual variation. So we probably need to define better what groups to be tested, determine what is the best strains to be used for certain subpopulation of patients, because the variation from one person to the other in terms of benefits from probiotics can differ quite a lot. And it seems that the type of diets or the dietary patterns that these people are on for many years will greatly influence the effect of probiotics, at least in terms of metabolic benefits. So that needs to be certainly something to consider in the future. I've discussed also at the meeting that we should not think about probiotics to be efficient or not only based on the fact they colonize the gut. It is not needed for probiotic bacteria to colonize the gut to be effective and to preventing intestinal inflammation and probably also for improving metabolic impairments in people with obesity and type 2 diabetes. We talk about the fact that diets is clearly a major confounder in the effect of probiotics. Again, I give a few examples from clinical trials, but even in animal studies where studies are perfectly controlled or almost perfectly controlled, and still you can see that depending on the diet you give an animal, you will have different efficacy of different type of probiotics. So definitely there needs to be more research to be conducted to determine the dietary confounders that can impact the ability of probiotics to have an effect not only in the gut, not only the microbiome, but also in terms of metabolic benefits and liver benefits. Then we switch to, you know, where should we go next in terms of the next generation, the third or fourth generation's probiotics. There was some discussions on my part that some groups have engineered bacteria in order to produce so-called molecules that can help to reduce type 2 diabetes, such as GLP-1. So there are some engineered probiotics that can reduce type 2 diabetes by producing more GLP-1. I've discussed that this is quite interesting and for the future, but of course the regulatory burden to actually allow these new bacteria or engineered bacteria to reach the market and to be recommended for clinical use is still something that we need to clearly establish and work on. It's not going to be easy, but that's a nice path for future development. I've shown also the case of yogurt because when you want to define novel probiotics for metabolic disease, I think it's very important to consider novel functions that are related to poor metabolism of glucose and lipid. You need to improve that in people with type 2 diabetes. And since yogurt has been shown to prevent the incidence of type 2 diabetes in many epidemiological studies, this is a very robust finding in the field of epidemiology. We decided to, in collaboration with Danone Nutrition Group, to do a study in an animal model of type 2 diabetes and see whether bacteria in the yogurt can actually improve metabolic syndrome or reduce the symptoms associated with metabolic syndrome. I've shown data from three different studies that were pulled together showing that actually if you add yogurt to a diet of an animal model of diabetes, you can reduce by 20 to 25% type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. So definitively yogurt supplementation in animal models of diabetes can do it. And so that's direct proof that yogurt treatment can reduce type 2 diabetes incidence. And what I've shown also is that in the search for novel microbes or novel mechanisms explaining this protective effect of yogurt, we've looked at the liver metabolomes and comparing it to the yogurt metabolome, which led to the discovery of a very interesting group of metabolites coming from the catabolism of branched-chain amino acids were able to actually were increase in yogurt, but also increase in the liver of animals treated with yogurt. I've shown evidence that these hydroxylated branched-chain amino acid metabolites are actually reduced in obesity and type 2 diabetes. And these animals, of course, are insulin resistant. But when you provide through yogurt supplementation these metabolites of branched chain amino acid metabolism, you can reduce not only fasting glucose, which is a hallmark of type 2 diabetes, but you can also reduce the amount of fat in the liver. So the animals are, you know, have a more healthy liver containing less triglycerides. And I've shown some evidence that these hydroxylated branched chain amino acid metabolites can actually reduce hepatic glucose production in vitro in hepatocytes, that it can even increase the ability of insulin to suppress glucose production, which is absolutely important to reduce type 2 diabetes because the hyperglycemia and that metabolic altered state is, you know, led or explained in part by overproduction of glucose by the liver. So you want to reduce that. And BCHA, these metabolites from BCAA, can actually do it in vitro. And I've shown that if you eat yogurt every day, the equivalent of 2 yogurts per day in these animals, but the equivalent of 2 yogurts per day for humans, the gut microbiota from these animals can produce more BCHA, though that's probably explained why yogurt prevents the development of type 2 diabetes. And I've shown some very new data, unpublished data, looking at the amount of these metabolites in commercial yogurts, and there was a lot of differences in different brands of yogurt. So clearly, different yogurt that you can find on the tablet in the grocery stores don't contain the same amount of BCHA, probably because they're made with different strains of bacteria. So there's a lot of effort to be devoted to finding the best strains of bacteria to produce these very interesting molecules in yogurt, but probably also in other fermented dairy products. And finally, I've discussed our efforts right now to study how bacteria catabolize a branched chain amino acid into these hydroxylated amino acids. Is the effect of yogurt coming from the BCHA already in the pot of yogurt when you eat it? Or is it coming from the bacteria that you get from the yogurt, which increases markedly the production in the gut, but also maybe in the liver of these hydroxylated branched chain amino acids? These are all studies that we need to be done. And when we talk about engineering bacteria, maybe we can engineer bacteria to produce more BCHA, not only in yogurt, but even in people, because the production of these molecules can also be obtained in humans. So it is something that is not only related to bacteria, but also present in mammalian cells and the host body. So this is what I presented at the meeting, and it was a great meeting, and I hope we're going to have more opportunities to show our work and cast our work in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Moret. Great guidance for anyone working in or interested in the field of probiotics and metabolic health. At the annual meeting this year, we were pleased to present two awards to outstanding early career researchers. Firstly, we'll hear from the 2025 winner of the Glenn Gibson Early Career Researcher Award, Dr. Peizhen Tian from Jiangyang University in China. Dr. Tian summarizes his talk at the meeting, Psychobiotics, Unveiling the Molecular Basis of Host Mood Regulation. Here's Dr. Tian.
I'm Peizhen Tian, and my research reveals how specific probiotics, what we call the psychobiotics, can actually help regulate our mood. This isn't science fiction. We have identified the exact molecules and mechanism behind this gut-brain conversation. What's fascinating is that ancient Chinese described this connection 2,500 years ago with saying like, heartbreak tears your gut apart. And we still use phrases like gut instinct or gut feelings today. Now, modern science is proving it. We focused on one particular psychobiotics called Bifidobacterium brain CCFM1025. In mice, it reduced depression-like behaviors while increasing serotonin in both gut and brain. But the real discovery came when we compared it to a similar but inactive bacterial strain. We found three key ways they differed. First, the psychobiotic strain make more acetate, which helps produce more serotonin. Second, it also produces purines, which can cause the brain inflammation. Third, most importantly, it creates a special molecule called endosrelactic acid, the ILA. The ILA doesn't work through the serotonin like we expected. Instead, it fights depression through a completely different pathway we didn't know about before. When we removed just one gene called LDH from the bacteria, it stopped making ILA and lost its antidepressant-like effects. But when we gave pure ILA to the mice, their mood improved just like with the original bacteria. This proves ILA is truly responsible for the benefits. This matters because right now, probiotics are treated like vitamins, as if all strains are the same. But our work shows tiny genetic difference, like having the LDH genes makes all difference in whether the bacteria can help with the mental health. While there are still much to learn, one thing is clear. The right bacteria do not just have digestion. They can also actually produce compounds that benefit our brain health in specific ways. This opens up an exciting new possibility for mental health treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tian. Valuable insights into some key mechanisms of the gut-brain axis. We're very excited to see where your research takes you next. For our final researcher of this episode, we're pleased to hear from Josiane Kenfack from the University of Yaoundé Wan in Cameroon. Josiane was the recipient of the 2025 Gregor Reid Award for Outstanding Scholars in Developing Nations. Let's hear from Josiane on her work on the LECA project, mapping the vaginal microbiome and the benefits of vaginal lactobacilli in Cameroon.
Yes, thank you very much. My title at the ISAP conference was the LECA project, mapping the vaginal microbiome and benefits of vaginal lactobacilli in Cameroon. In this conference, I present the LECA project that we conducted in Cameroon. The LECA project is a sisterhood of ISALA program. You may certainly know ISALA program is the world's largest citizen science on vaginal health. In the LECA project, we have three objectives. We wanted to understand the ecology and functionality of vaginal microbiome of Cameroonian women. And also we have a particular interest on beneficial bacteria. And for this beneficial bacteria, we want to explore probiotic potential of local lactobacillus strains. And our third objective on this project is to raise awareness about vaginal health and intimate health practices. It is important to notice that the LECA project was done in Cameroon. Cameroon is considered as Africa in miniature. Africa in miniature because in Cameroon, you have like the ecosystem and also ethnic group that you can find in most African countries. And this diversity in the same country is really interesting in the vaginal microbiome. And this project is also really interesting because actually all the vaginal microbiome data we have actually come from high-income countries. Actually, we also have like many female populations are underrepresented in vaginal microbiome research, among which African women. That's why actually we don't have more knowledge about the vaginal microbiome of the women. For example, we don't know what is the healthy vaginal microbiome in African women, in African context. And it's very important also to study the vaginal microbiome of this population because we know that the vaginal microbiome is diverse and is impacted by many factors. So if you have like research on high-income country and you have data from this high-income country, it's not possible or it will be difficult to take this result and to apply it and to consider that as a norm for other countries. So in my project, the first step in my project, we do the vaginal health campaign and also the vaginal health research. The vaginal health campaign has the aim was to raise awareness about vaginal health and also to empower women to take their vaginal health in their own hands. And after that, we also do the vaginal health research. The aim of the vaginal health research was to take samples, vaginal health samples, and in this case, it was cell samples. So women took their samples and sent their samples to the lab. And when we have these samples, it was possible for us to try to achieve the two objectives, that was to study the ecology and functionality of vaginal microbiome and also to try to identify probiotic candidates. We did the LECA project in the rural and urban area. In the rural area, we went to the north of Cameroon. In the urban area, we did a study in the central region of Cameroon, especially Yaoundé. What we did, especially in the rural area, is that we tried to involve women in the process because it's a region where that is more patriarchal, and it was very important for us to, it was necessary for us to first have the authorization of the men before discussing with the women. And with our team that it was necessary to take this opportunity to involve women, to involve men in the management of vaginal health of the women. So the preliminary result we obtained after this, the preliminary result was the result of the vaginal microbiome profile from healthy women in the rural and healthy women in the urban area shows that in the rural area, we have more women with a vaginal profile risk in Lactobacillus crispatus compared to the urban area. Why we try to do the comparison between the data of the healthy women we have in Cameroon and the healthy women that was published by Professor Sarah Liebert's team? Because we observe that our healthy women in Cameroon are dominated by Tobacillus ines and Prevotella. Why healthy women in Belgium are dominated by Crispatus and Lactobacillus ines. And this result also shows that it's very important to also study another population, just not to focus on one population. And then when we observe this result with healthy women, we also ask the question to know how can a vaginal microbiome can be in a disease context. And for these steps, we first begin by HIV because HIV is still a health problem in Cameroon. So for this, we have one objective to determine the impact of HIV and pregnancy on the vaginal microbiome in Cameroon. And to achieve this objective, we have pregnant women HIV positive and HIV negative at the second trimester of pregnancy. And with this women, we took samples of the vaginal samples and also blood samples to identify some cytokines. The preliminary result we obtained are the result of the vaginal profile. And still, the vaginal profile showed us, this is just the preliminary result we have actually, showed that pregnant women HIV negative has, if you want to take about the dominance of lactobacillus, we have less dominance, less women with dominance in lactobacillus ines, and also very less dominance of lactobacillus crispatus in pregnant women HIV positive compared to pregnant women HIV negative. And still, this result is just the preliminary result. We are still we are still in the lab, and also we are still doing the bioinformatics to analyze more data and to have all the data. So the LECA project is ongoing. The next step we want to do in this project is to first finalize all the analysis of this data to have a clear view. After the analysis, we want to answer the question how healthy vaginal microbiome is in African women. And also, we want to study the functionality of beneficial bacteria we isolate from our samples. So the next step of this project is to investigate factors influence the ecology and dynamics of the vaginal microbiome ecosystem in Cameroon. And also, as I said before, we also want to identify local probiotic candidates against key vaginal pathogens. And actually, what we are doing in Cameroon is a project related to the LECA project, the project Envira project. The aim of this project is to determine the impact of three menstrual products on the vaginal microbiome of Cameroonian women, and also to compare this with women from Peru and Switzerland.
Thank you, Josiane. Pioneering work in this region and the potential to make significant scientific and health impacts. We're looking forward to hearing more in the future. A big thank you to all of our guests for sharing their work at our annual meeting and also with our ISAP community here on this podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode.